You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 287, and I am your stand-in host, Andrew Kinkella, and I'm here today with only Doug.
Everyone.
And, huh?
I was just saying hi to everyone.
Oh, you're trying to say hi. See, already there's tension between us, Doug. And I think we should fill everyone in, though. The reason why it's just you and me is because everyone else had something better to do. What's up with that? You know what I mean? Leaving Doug and I in a thing I'd like to call the lurch. So here we are, deep in the lurch. And we actually, though, I think came up with a really interesting thing to talk about. And I had class yesterday, and a student of mine was asking about advanced degrees in the UK. You know, of which I know precious little. And so in talking about that right before this show, Doug said, hey, I work in the UK. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's great. So I think for this show, it'll be me just sort of asking Doug about what it's like to work in the UK as an archaeologist. How does the education system work for an archaeologist in the UK? How do you bring that experience back if you move back to the United States, and so on. So, Doug, that's what I got. I guess I'll just start with the question on sort of the advanced degrees, whether they be master's or PhD. How does that work?
Yeah, actually, probably be slightly easier. So it'll make a little bit more sense if I just slightly go back.
Yeah.
And we start with undergraduate. And then one key thing to sort of understand about working in the UK or coming over and doing school is, so it's a United Kingdom. So technically it's three different kingdoms and they all are semi-devolved, plus Wales adds a little extra thing in there. Wales is not a kingdom. It was a principality. They were conquered way too soon. They couldn't do the union, all historical stuff, but they are in charge of their education system. So the four nations of the UK, England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, each sort of control their own education system, a bit similar to how it is in the States, with each state essentially setting a lot of standards, having some slight differences. But, you know, then you have like sort of federal government where it puts down regulations. If you want to accept federal money, you have to follow those. And most everyone does. But that's kind of key because there are some differences. So in the rest, most of the UK, it's actually a 3-year undergraduate.
Huh.
And it's very different than America, where you would typically get a much broader education. You know, a liberal arts education is, I believe, the correct terminology for that, in that, you know, yeah, you go to university and you have certain credits you have to do. So, you might end up having to do 2 math classes, maybe one. You have to do some sort of English class or up to like, English 102, or, each university will be slightly different. You'll have to do like a sociology, or, you have to do some sort of hard science, and you have to sort of mix that together. In most of the UK, that's not it. You basically jump into your degree and you pretty much do that. You don't usually do classes outside of your degree and what's required. You could do sort of what's like double honors, which would be like almost the US equivalent of like a double major, as it were. So you can kind of mix up stuff. But usually people tend to do it the same. I think the most unique one I saw was probably Tristan, who helps run the podcast network. I think
right.
Chemistry and archaeology. But usually you actually get something like ancient history or history and archaeology. They don't actually usually double up that far apart.
Right.
And the difference, though, is Scotland, where the undergraduate is actually 4 years. And then just to confuse everything and everyone, technically, some of the Scottish degrees, the 4 years are actually called MAs.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Cambridge and Oxford as well, you can also apply to have your undergraduate actually be called an MA. It's still a bachelor's.
Right.
It still ties into this whole, well, back when the UK was part of the EU, but this international bachelorette, it's this whole system of being able to like align all the different countries and, you know, make sure their degrees are fairly similar. So if you got a degree in, say, Italy, it would count in France. And so that's somewhat standardized it, and it somewhat standardizes it to America as well. So even though, and like Edinburgh, did, like Scotland has that as well, where there's like the Scottish MA,
mm-hmm.
at like Edinburgh, even though it's a 4 year, it's all bachelor's. It's the equivalent of a bachelor's, right. But it's very different. And then like shockingly, the time as well. So, all right, Andrew, it's been like almost, God, we're starting to get or at least 15 years, maybe 20 years since I was in my undergraduate.
Yeah.
Is it 16 or 18 weeks typically in the U.S.?
For like per semester?
Yeah.
It actually depends. you can have, I think 16-ish is more typical. It's like 16 and a half is a very typical semester.
Yeah. I also remember like some people can also do like tri-semester things.
Yes, where quarters. They call it quarters, even though there's three, and but you count summer as a fourth. So we have our own oddities, you know, on our side.
Yeah. But generally in the UK, the semesters, so they do like a sort of split in half semesters, basically, though not quite... They don't always quite break exactly how we do it. And they have like their Easter break, like they actually call it Easter break, and it can be several weeks long. It's a bit different system, but it's also about 10 to 12 weeks.
So what is 10 to 12 weeks?
A semester.
Okay.
In the UK.
Right.
And then also like, again, I'm going, and I know like across the United States, what is there, 8,000 colleges and universities? Everyone's slightly different, but, you know, credit hours is a fairly common one. So, you know, in the US, if you had 3 credit hour class, that meant you were going to be in class for, you know, 3 hours a week,
right?
Usually. Unless, of course, you did something like Art Studio and then you just double that. So if it's 3 credit hours, you're actually doing 6. I know some degrees do it slightly different, but that's a probably pretty general rule.
I think so. That's true.
For the equivalent, you might actually only spend 1 hour a week in the UK. So like it's a lot shorter and it is a lot less, like you just have so much less time face to face. Like, you know, because usually, you know, if you're doing like 16 credit hours, you'd probably be in class, you know, about 16, 17 hours a week or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the UK, you might push 10.
Maybe. Dude, I didn't know any of this. And I just find this whole conversation fascinating. Like, I love all of this, Doug, because students have asked me, you know, for decades at this point about some of this stuff. And I would just sort of mealy mouth it, you know, I'd be like, well, I think. And I knew none of this. This has just been a, you know, this black hole mystery to me. So I think this is awesome. I have one or two questions just in terms of, okay, so if in the UK system, you're kind of specializing very early, it sounds like, right? You're going for your bachelor's and it's very specialized. Is the understanding that I learned how to read and write in high school, like is that the understanding, like I already know how to write because I got that in high school, so I'm going to college to focus?
Yes. Also, there's different, again, sounds super confusing for different people, because technically some parts, like college is actually, most people essentially finish high school at 16 and then spend the last 2 years, which sometimes is called college. Even though you also have, like, so there's, like, Edinburgh College as well. you know, but sometimes like that. And basically you study for these various exams, and Scotland has a different name for it, and England has a different name for it. And you take these ones, and then basically your entire university career is based off of these exams. And you might take like, so you might take a big, deep exam in like history and English and math and geography and underwater pottery, basket weaving, something, you know, you take so many of them, and then you get like an A or B, or, you know, various different scores. Again,
right,
slightly different in Scotland because, you know, it was a union in 1707 and they were able to keep their own education system because mm-hmm. it was a union, not a conquest.
Right.
But yeah, basically they do that. And so imagine like if it was the ACTs or SATs, but you've actually studied for like 2 years for them.
Yeah.
And they're much more intense. Actually, that was becoming a thing. I'm pretty sure it's still a thing. SAT2s? Is that still a thing?
I've never heard it called that, but we have the SATs, and then for grad school there's the GREs, I think.
SAT2s was a thing, or at least, you know, about 20 years ago, where you mm-hmm. could take like a history SAT test thing, and sometimes universities would count it as a college credit.
Oh yeah, level, we call those AP tests, advanced placement. So you take the AP test. That's what those are called now.
Yeah. Well, so actually slightly different than AP, because AP mm-hmm. definitely, if you got it, most schools would accept, you know, on that 5-point scale, like a 3 or yes. 4 or 5.
Yes.
Yeah. It's harder to say, but then like universities basically, they offer places and they'll be like, oh, all right, if you got out of your 4 tests, 4 A's and 1 B, we'll give you a place at Oxford. Well,
right.
They'd be like, you need 6 of these A's and, you know, all these different things, but it is a lot more intense at that level.
Sure.
So like your exams to get into university are more intense. So I did master's and PhD. So I actually ended up doing some teaching as well. I am going to piss people off, but I think they think much more higher of themselves, thinking that their students are much more advanced coming in and don't need a liberal arts.
Mm-hmm.
And you do see it, especially with like, well, what they'd call first years, we'd call freshmen.
Right.
Yeah. Not, I would say that they're almost at a comparable level to the US, maybe a little bit better in that they might be there and they might not. But honestly, to be 100% honest with you, I do think liberal arts, they should be taking more classes and mm-hmm. developing better writing skills or better science skills, a more broad-based education to help with those areas.
I totally agree. I've always been a fan of that. I understand the critique of people just taking ballroom dancing as their major and then coming out of college in huge college debt with like no skills. I totally get that critique, but I never want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I want to be like, no, dude, like I want it all. You know, I want, hey, let's have a strong liberal education and at the same time, a focus that also has, you know, skills and that kind of thing on top of it. So, well, this is fascinating. We're already at the break for the first bit. So when we come back, more on learning in the UK. So we'll see you guys in a minute. Hello, and welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 287. And Doug and I have been talking about the education system in the UK, and we will bring it around to archaeology as we go. So, Doug, you were on a roll, and it's just been fascinating. So if you just want to continue, just go for it.
Yeah, I think we'll pick up a little bit where we were just talking about, you know, preparedness of students.
Right.
But also, maybe difference in the UK in that, in America, there's a larger range of educational opportunities and sort of educational opportunities that can move you along to get a degree. So, Andrew, you're at, you know, a community college. You're doing 2 years degrees. And there's a lot of people who, you know, go for a 2-year degree associate. Some just stop at that point. But mm-hmm. others are using that as a springboard to go to a full bachelor's.
Yep.
And honestly, I highly recommend it in the States, depending on where you are, because, you know, 2 years at a community college costs almost nothing.
You save so much money. I know, people don't realize sometimes it's like it's pocket change, dude, in comparison.
Yeah. It's a great thing. the UK doesn't really have that. And also they've had a huge change over the last decade and a half with their, well, a little bit longer with their educational system. So Scotland, still mostly free university. Wales charges much lower. England, you know, it's about 9,000 a student, and it's all locked. Like, there's a much higher central control there. So all universities have to charge the same amount. There's no, like variation. There's none of this, like, you can go to Harvard for 60,000.
Right.
You pay the same amount if you go to Teesside College as you do to Oxford. But there's been a lot of changes. There's been introductions. And part of that is they basically gutted what we would call continuing education.
Right.
And they'd sort of call it lifelong learning over here. And you know, it's like a community college. You probably also get a lot of people who come in sort of later in life. And
yes,
they're interested in, sometimes it's just like one class, or, you know, they just, you're just taking a class because you're interested in a subject.
They just want to learn stuff. More. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's still like tiny bits of departments, but there used to be like, the numbers, it was like maybe 8,000, I think at the peak, which was like maybe 2006 or 2005, 8,000-10,000 people taking these sort of lifelong learning courses in the UK. And now it's down in the hundreds.
That's so sad.
They basically gutted it. And also, like, a lot of those courses sort of lead people on to potentially degrees later in life.
They do. I've seen it.
Yeah.
Yep. I've seen it multiple times. What happens is you'll get people who have retired, or maybe they were successful. Maybe they were a successful lawyer or something, you know, and they've retired, but they've been like, man, I've just always been super interested in archaeology, you know. And I've seen people like have full on second careers, you know. And it starts in that lifelong learning phase.
Yeah. Mostly in the UK, there's not that sort of pipeline, as it were.
Right.
They've killed most of it. And then also that sort of sink or swim, like, as we were talking about, like, when you get to university, actually, you know, the sort of liberal arts, being able to get that extra sort of support or a different class to teach you maybe some of those other skills. If you basically fail out, you fail out. And there's not, it's much more of a, you go to university or you go learn a trade. And there used to be like huge retraining programs, especially when they closed down a lot of the mines and stuff. A lot of the miners went on to actually go to get university degrees, second careers. That just doesn't exist anymore. It's much more of a, you either are in there, you get the degree this way. Or, and again, if you're coming back, there are some lifelong courses. There are, like, universities still have a very small department that does that, what they call lifelong learning. It's very small. You can kind of slightly build your way into a degree, but really not all of those credits will quite transfer correctly. And because it's so specialized, like the lifelong learning, you'll have a whole range of different courses. It's actually really awesome. So in, like, Scotland, I've done a course on data visualization at Glasgow. I've done I shouldn't use the term course. Course would be like what we call a degree course. They'd actually call it a module. So instead of like a class or a course, what we call in the States, they call a module.
Good
so
God, I've done a module.
Yeah, different terms. I've done a module on like data visualization at Glasgow. I did one with Dundee, which was how to communicate with comics. Awesome, awesome thing.
Yeah.
But those credits, don't, you know, like if you were to build up in the United States, you could build up a bunch of sort of like that liberal arts credits and that would count. You really can't do that because it's so narrowly focused. So you basically, coming back for a second career, you basically have to commit to doing a full-time or part-time degree, you know, 3 years, right, 6 years, or, you know, 4 or 8 if you're in Scotland. And you there's not really a chance. You can maybe pick up occasional few credits here or there, maybe start a few in archaeology, but then you have to really commit. And that's the same with pretty much any degree. It's much harder than in the States, where you can sort of, you know, over a couple of years, take a couple of classes, maybe get an interest, and then go back, and then you have a bunch of other credits that can really help you to get like a build up to get your bachelor's. It's really much all or nothing. So I've probably talked enough about the undergraduates.
Yeah.
There are some, you know, you get some students, a few Americans who come over to do undergraduate. Again, 3 years if you're in the rest of the UK, 4 years if you're in Scotland. It's, you know, also be careful. Like, yeah, while the fees are 9,000 for UK people in England, free in Scotland, they can charge. There's no cap on foreign students. So for an undergraduate, it doesn't actually make that much sense, because you can come over and you're paying like 20, 30, or 40,000 pounds. It used to be worse when the pounds were, you know, worth a lot more dollars. Now it's not too bad of a deal. If you go to like the England, where it's only a 3-year degree, you could still probably make it financially viable, you know, especially compared to like doing out of state. In state, I don't think there's a economic advantage. The only thing is, like, it's cool because you're in a different country, different cultures,
right,
different way of doing things. But yeah, basically where you can really make really good money on most places is when you come and do the master's degree, because they have basically sort of two types of masters. One is a taught master's, which is you basically do, it's only 1 year, and that's the same across all the UK. So Scotland for once isn't different. And basically it's taught, again, shorter semesters, shorter contact hours. I mean, you're looking 10, 12 hours. It's a lot more, you're doing stuff on your own. Oh, also something else is, you know, in the States, you'd have like midterms, and you probably have assignments happening throughout the year. So you might have like an essay due maybe like 4 weeks in, or like a small project or a little test or a quiz or something like that.
Yeah, very typical.
Yeah, not in the UK. Basically, most of it goes all the way to the end. And then you might have a final essay you turn in, and it's one. And you might have a final exam. And you might have a combination where it's a mixture of like a final exam, a final essay. And they might split up whatever your grade is between those two. But especially at undergraduate level, it's mainly exams. They'll differ between different degrees in, you know, different subjects and stuff like that. But basically, it's all or nothing. So there's not like that sort of, you can sort of mess up once and that's it. You mess up on your final exams, you have to retake. And you have to do the course again. There's none of this sort of averaging it out.
Yeah.
Doing those calculations at the end. I remember always, you get to your final, you're like, oh, I'm just passed. All I have to do is get like a 70 on that, I'm okay.
Yeah.
No, it's totally very different.
That happens all the time. You know, students are like, okay, if I can just get a 68.25, I'll be all right. And honestly, I never liked that. It's funny, as we've been talking, for the most part, I've been like, yeah, United States, US, USA, right? I've been like we're doing things right. The one thing about that sort of all or nothing, there are aspects of that I kind of like. You know, that's not all bad.
What do you like about that?
Because on the flip side, it just cuts out the whiners and the middlemen. You know, it's like, look, you're here to learn for this class. We're gonna have a test at the end, you know, and then as a professor, I'm here to like help you as best I can through this whole journey. But then we're gonna have this test. Barring like when you do stuff throughout the semester, sometimes they'll be like it enables much more magical thinking. And what I mean by that is like, a student will be like, why did I get an F in this class? I got a C on the first test. And it's like, yeah, but you got like an F on everything else. You know, it's when it's just sort of a thing at the end, it just calls it. It's like, here you go. You know, so I'm of two minds. I'm not saying I'm all in on it, but I respect that side. That's what I would say.
All right. I'd also say it's a bit different as well, grading. So, you know, usually, again, mostly across the state, and this will be a generalization, you're grading your students' papers and you know the student you're grading, correct?
Always.
Yeah. It's anonymous in the UK. So you get it back and you basically grade, and you may know, because maybe the students have come to like office hours and you've worked on the essay with them. So then you'll know. And I've always recommended to students to do that, because, you know, it's the best way to improve.
Yes.
But it's anonymous, and it's usually, there's a second person who reviews it. And then again, those grades go out to another review system. Now, this whole review system where basically, so allegedly, name doesn't matter. So all degrees, you have to, they have like external examiners or external, no, external examiner is not the right term. I forget what it's called. But basically, every degree, every program in the UK has to have externals who basically look at the entire program and like make suggestions. And so they're like, oh, well, you know, maybe you should teach this slightly different, things like that. And then they also review like a sampling of the essays. And the idea is that whether you get a degree in Oxford or whether you get a degree in Glasgow, they're equivalent.
Right. Course, I get that.
Name doesn't, they're not, because name makes a huge difference. but that's like the grading. Sorry, there's about a roundabout way of, I sort of had to explain, so it's anonymous. And
no, this is, dude, it's like sometimes on this show, you know, we go over and I'm like, oh man, we got to reel it in. I think this is great. You're explaining things like straightforward. People want to know, just go for it, man.
Well, so this comes back to like the slight problem with the like all or nothing is basically, especially like for that first year students, you get to the end and you don't know if anyone's been struggling along the way. And then also it's anonymous. So you can't, like, I'd get essays back and I don't know if the issue is maybe they had dyslexia, if they weren't just prepared, or if like English was a second language.
Sure.
And the problem is like, I get this back and it's all or nothing. And it's like,
So
the archaeology part's not bad, but it's not a coherent essay.
Yeah.
And you basically like, there's no way to catch it. And then there's like, I remember writing in one of the things, I was like, hey man, you, as the feedback, I was like, you really need to go see. So the library at the University of Edinburgh had like support and stuff for essay writing in English as a second language and stuff like that.
You know what I hate, Doug? You know what I hate? I hate it when you have a really good point. God damn it. I totally agree with you. I get that. I get the like intervention earlier on. I was just thinking in terms of tests and stuff. I'm like, oh, all or nothing at the end. That's cool. But I'm always for like getting to know the students, and you're totally right to get something from them early on, just as a check of kind of like, how are you doing? What do you know? What do you not know? I stand aside to your mastery.
Well, it also it's hard as like I put in comments like suggesting that they go and possibly get support for English as a second language or dyslexia. And those comments were stripped out.
Oh, yeah, that's a bummer.
Because it had to be anonymous.
Right.
And if I was saying things like, I get it, like, I couldn't, there's a lot of issues with writing that people can have, and there's different reasons behind it. I get that, but like, they either had dyslexia or English was a second language. Mm-hmm. And they needed support with that, but I couldn't put those comments in there. So basically, they didn't do well. And if they didn't do well in my class, I'm assuming the same problem occurred in all the other ones. And they probably just were hammered at the end. And either, this is another thing, grading scale is completely different in the UK.
What is this alien landscape you're taking me to?
Yeah. So you have what's called a first, which is anything above a 70. You have a sort of 2-1, which is between like 60 and 70, or, you know, 60 and 69, a 2-2. Or, well, you know, it's there. And basically, if you get below like a either 40 or 50, depending, you failed. But they also, they do a huge grading on a bell curve. So, the biggest shock for like Americans when they get there is all of a sudden, like, you get like a 65. And that's actually a pretty good grade.
Right.
And like, but you, people you get used to like 90 or, like 90s. Like, and again, like, it's all like this, they usually don't give like 80. Like, when I say like a 70 or above, it's usually you're getting 70, 71, 72. I think the highest grade I was able to get, because again, had to go to a second person to grade and agree with.
Yeah.
I think the highest I was ever able to give out was like a 76.
Right. Wow. See, I didn't know any of this.
Yeah.
Like this is, I just find this fascinating, dude. And actually, with that, I get, you know, looking at the time, man, we'll have to go to segment three, where we'll just have to, like, you know, answer all the questions. And we got to get to the sort of the master's and PhD and their length of time. I'm so interested in that. Anyway, we'll continue in a moment. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back one more time to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 287. And Doug has been talking about the strange, wonderful world of the UK education system. And we'll just keep going. So, Doug, just continue. This has been a total eye opener and super interesting for me.
All right. So actually, it's kind of built up. So now that I've given you a lot of background, I can actually sort of explain the master's, which basically there's two types of master's, and it's the same sort of setup that we've just gone over for sort of undergraduate. You know, what they call a degree would be a course. So you take a course in archaeology or, you know, wherever that is, and that's actually your degree. They call it modules, which would be, you know, like our classes, what we'd probably call courses as well. You know, right. 1 or 2 hours a week for each class, maybe 10 to 12 in a week of hours, maybe a little less, not a lot of FaceTime, you know, 12 weeks-ish, but sometimes it's not really a real 12 weeks because, you know, the first week is sort of a blow-off week, and then the last week, you know, yeah, it's shortened. It's about 2 semesters, and usually, same as undergraduate, in your master's, it'll be either a test. You tend to do a lot more essays by the time you get to a master's, at least in archaeology.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, again, it is like you turn in one paper, and that's it. Determines what happens in your course. And that's basically it. So you have 2 semesters, maybe like 5 or 6 modules. It depends how big the modules are. So that's, you know, maybe 8 to 12 hours of like contact with your professor, which again has a slightly different thing. Like when they call it, use the term professor, it means full professor. Mm-hmm. Whereas like your assistant professor would be like a lecturer. And then sometimes they have a thing called like associate or reading or a reader, which is like your associate professor. Mm-hmm. And so, and again, there's been some Americanization where some terms have been imported. So I think like Bristol does like assistant professor, associate professor, and full professor.
Right.
But for the most part, yeah, it's like lecturers, like what you'd call your assistant.
Dude. Okay. Yeah. And I'm trying to get all the terminology correct in my head.
Yeah. But like, so I'm gonna use the Americanism, but yeah, your contact with your professor, usually it's actually a lecturer, is going to be that. And you do that. And then that's for taught, like, you know, it depends on how many credits are in the module. And then you have to end up, you know, with the same amount of credits, which are not, they're not the same as credit hours, but you know, you break it up. And then you do that, and then you have a dissertation sort of thesis that you do at the end, and that is, you know, it depends on the degree, but for a taught, maybe between 12 or 14,000 at the low end and 20,000 max.
This is words?
Words,
yeah. Yeah. About how many pages?
So that's it. Another thing is in the UK, it's all by words.
Yeah.
So you don't turn in essays by pages, you turn in by words. So your essay, like for one of those modules, might be 3,000 words, might be 1,500. And that doesn't quite work because then, you know, you can do larger font. Like people aren't fiddling with like the margins of fonts. I mean, there's a standard, you know, Romans 12 font, double space, stuff like that. But you don't end up with the America where people are slightly trying to adjust little bits of font here and there to hit that page limit.
Yeah.
So it's all by words. And so, yeah, it could be as low as like 10,000 words up to about 20. There's also sort of a master's of philosophy, which you could take as standalone. So like that'd be a master's of arts or a master's of science. Luckily, those terms are the same. It's not different. That's your top master's. You can also do an MPhil, master's of philosophy, which doesn't really have any teaching. You might have maybe 1 or 2 modules, and it'd be like a 30,000 word sort of thesis. And that you can either take it standalone or you can take that as part of your PhD, which is supposed to be 3 years. So you do like your first year, you do, if you didn't do a master's, so I did a taught master's and they didn't make me do the MPhil again for my PhD. But if you were to go straight from undergraduate into a PhD, which you can do, you don't have to do like a taught master's. You basically do a 30,000 sort of mini PhD thesis, 30,000 words.
Yeah.
They look at it and your outcomes are either like you fail everything, they kick you out of the course. You somewhat fail in that they fail you to an MPhil. So like they're not going to continue your PhD.
Yeah.
and you end out with an MPhil. You can also take an MPhil standalone as well. So
right.
You got to be careful, because some people will be like, oh, did you fail out of PhD? And they're like, no, I just took an M, you know, just a...
Yes. Okay. So the United States system is actually vaguely similar on this. What's funny is, as we were talking, I did some quick calculations in terms of your word counts. And I actually think the length of a master's thesis in both countries is vaguely similar. You know, like we're talking 75 pages, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's what my, I think my master's thesis was 70 pages, you know, like so we're not talking crazy differences. It's just the labels for everything are different. The UK system, the whole, I won't go into how it compares to, you know, specifically to the US system, because it'll just get way in the weeds, but it's not far off in terms of, oh, in the US it'd be like, oh, we're just giving you a terminal master's instead of being able, or we're just throwing you a master's degree instead of allowing you to continue on to the PhD, you know, so it's not a complete waste of your time.
Very similar system. It's just less taught time. So usually, so if you were in a terminal master's would be maybe 2 years of teaching or being in taught courses, and a PhD, you'd probably do your first 2 years.
When you say 2 years, I'm sorry to break in just for a minute. When you say 2 years of teaching, what is that? Does that mean going to class for 2 years?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay. Sorry. See, when you say 2 years of teaching, I feel like, wait, you're a TA for 2 years, right? So it's 2 years of going to class. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Continue. So
in the United States, it's between about 2 or 3 years of where you're that, and then, you know, it'll go on for like another couple of years where you just work on your dissertation or thesis or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, in the United States, it's supposed to sort of end at five, but people go six, seven.
Nobody goes five. Like, yeah. It's like,
yeah.
Never and
again, in the UK, it's a similar thing where, you know, it's supposed to be 3 years. And again, if you could do like a taught master's and then sort of skip the MPhil part, but it's still supposed to be 3 years, but it's 3 years straight research. Uh-huh. Like there's no, you don't have to ever take any classes if you don't want to.
Right.
They might give you like some really basic, your first year, like a how to do research throwaway.
Wow.
Like
it doesn't count. Yeah.
It doesn't count as like a actual like credits. Like it's not gonna count for your PhD. Not everyone does that. And it basically, again, much more of a sink or swim.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of buildup. And so you actually have to have like, and you know, like in the US, people like maybe spend that first 2 years of like while they're taking sort of classes and before they do their big sort of exams where they either decide if you have a terminal master's or not.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of work on your ideas. You maybe not have a fully formed one. There's not really that chance. You pretty much have to go in with a thesis.
Yeah.
And you work on that. And you can sort of revise it. And some people change, you know, topics dramatically. And it takes longer. But yeah, it's basically, there's nothing else. If you go straight to a PhD, you basically, that's it. All you're doing is your thesis, nothing else.
So So there's basically, so what I'm getting is in the UK system, whether it's master's or PhD, you go straight in and you're just researching for your like project. There's no like classes and stuff really. You're just like researching.
If it's not taught. So there's a taught master's and then there's like the MPhil, which is, pure research, and a PhD, which again, they might knock you down to an MPhil. Also pure research. There's nothing there. They do also a lot less sort of TAing or, you know, research assistant stuff. Like you don't actually get a lot of practice. They're pushing more towards it. So they're now offering more sort of studentship where you know, if you teach one or two classes more towards the US, but probably still again not as intense, because sometimes like people in the US will be teaching like four and four, you know, four classes each semester while they're doing their PhD, which is insane. So it's still less, but it used to be almost nothing. So like people would basically come out of their PhD programs, not so much anymore, but you know, two decades ago, it was almost unheard of to do any teaching.
Yeah.
And so people would come out and then they'd get a lectureship and then that was it. They dropped you in and like, well, that first year of teaching, you got to learn how to teach.
Right.
There was no practice, none of that sort of being a TA, none of that. It's getting more towards the American system. Where you can now, there are now more funding, but also a whole lot less funding. And again, this is because they're now charging a lot more money for degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the, you know, in the US, and there are certain programs, I think maybe it's like Vanderbilt or Vassar or something, like they don't accept any PhD unless you have fully funded.
Right.
And you know, in the United States, like a lot of people will be partially funded some way. Like either, you know,
I was
the few. Yeah, the few people that get like the National Science Foundation, whatever, PhD stuff. There's a couple of those, a couple other funds. But, you know, a lot of it is like TA teaching undergraduate courses.
Yep.
Or, sorry, you know, classes and
all no, that it's, stuff. That's true. That's what it was, you know.
When I went, and this was about a decade ago for my PhD, they really didn't have that. They had about two, right after me, they started two people who basically got part funding. And actually, the only reason I was able to do my PhD is I split funding with someone else. I didn't actually have to teach.
Mm-hmm.
I taught a little bit for the money, but they'd given out like that year, maybe there was like three sources of funding, and two of us split one of them in archaeology out of like maybe 10 or 15 people. You know, so like, you know, in the States, at least, you know, there are statistics. I think it's like 60 to 70%. Maybe, and it'll differ between university, will probably have some sort of funding, usually like a TA ship or a research assistant or something like that. Whereas in the UK, it's almost exactly switched, where maybe only 10, 20, 30% of the students will be on some sort of funding that way.
Yeah. Damn.
And then this comes back to like the sort of money thing. Cause so again, this was years ago, but you can go there. And if you're thinking, you know, if you have to go out of state in the US, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 per year. That's 2 years, maybe three for a master's, where even if you're going to the UK where it's like 20,000, which, you know, is probably about 25,000 US, it's only for 1 year. It's a great deal price-wise. And potentially PhD-wise as well. Like if you can't get funding in the States, only paying for 3 years. And they only usually charge you for 3 years. So if you like do the fourth or like a fifth year, they charge like a nominal fee of like £1,000 or something. But it's not like a full charge for the full 3 years.
Yeah.
And so if you have no funding in the States, and usually, you know, like especially if you're going to CRM where like you're actually looking for a terminal master's, you're not looking necessarily to go to a PhD.
Right.
And there's not as many opportunities to get funding for that. Usually it makes sense. I remember because, like, you know, so I went to UNM, and UNM thinks itself a bit higher and mightier than it is and wants to be. And they wanted to start University of New Mexico.
Yeah.
They don't accept any of their undergraduates into their master's programs, except very rarely, at least when I went.
Yeah.
So I was looking, because they only wanted undergraduates from Berkeley and Michigan. And, no, it's that was their sort of academic thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I there was no way I was ever going to be able to go to UNM. I might have been able to go to like New Mexico State, but I was looking at out of state basically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Eastern possibly. You know, there's a couple of options, but small state and the closest one to me. So I'd have to move to like, you know, a couple hundred miles away to a different university, different town. Or basically go out of state. So for me, it made so much more sense. Actually, when I came over to the UK, I was actually planning on just doing 1 year master's so I could get the Secretary of Interior's qualifications and come back to the CRM. Things happened. I ended up getting partially funded for a PhD. So I was like, well, it was also the middle of, you know, the Great Recession. I was like, yeah, there's not any jobs. I might as well just stick it out a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
But for people who are coming back,
yeah, this is what I'm curious about, because it's like, you know, these differences in the systems, like what I'm kind of getting is like, all right, the UK system is no BS. You just go in and you just like research your project and you finish it. It seems like, you know, the finished product, whether it be a master's or PhD, and the actual research is not too terribly different. But so the knowledge in those places would be about the same. But in terms of kind of obviously a more broad-based education, the ability to teach, the sort of heaviness of each degree, like the ones in the United States seem a little bit heavier. So I'm curious, like can degrees from the UK work in the US?
Yeah. So all you have to do is, because, you know, in the US, degrees work on accreditation. So you either have national accreditation, which is surprisingly considered less. So a lot of like community colleges have national accrediting mm-hmm. bodies. And then you have the regional ones, which tend to do the 4-year and masters, and those right. tend to be held in a higher degree. But any degree, again, the United States works in a way of like, you know, it's a union. It's a union of 50 states. Each yeah. state does their own education. But to be able to accept, and so you can, you know, if you get a degree in Alabama, you can work in Alaska. Uh-huh. It's accreditation.
Yes.
And all you have to do is when you come back to the United States, you pay one of those accrediting bodies. When I looked at it, it was like maybe $200. It's probably like $1,000 now, mm-hmm. you know, inflation. And also that was like a decade ago. But, you know, you just come back, you pay it, they accreditate your degree, and it will count for anyone who, like any federal agency or state agency that requires a degree,
right.
that's it. All you have to do is pay that little extra. Some people do not know that they need to do that. They just need yeah. to know, like, if you're going over there, just budget, find out how much it costs. It's not, you know, not
right.
It's a couple hundred. It's not too much.
Yeah.
Get that, and they have to accept it.
Yeah, that is so huge. Like, God, people, yeah. you know, advanced students going into this, they need to know that. They need to know that like out of the gate. It's like, if you're going to the UK, you need to know that you can get your degree accredited and it will count. I will say, you know, coming, sometimes it's a little difficult too, I think, for people to get their degrees in the UK, because to us in the US, it looks thinner. You know, like, so on the, like, when you hear the time yeah. frame, you're like, that just doesn't have the depth of a U.S. degree. So sometimes I think if you're in like a hiring situation, somebody with a degree from the United States might have an edge.
Yeah, I'd say more than that, because what I hear is yeah. the term, I love it, and not as a sarcastic love, I do find it funny, is a drive-by degree is what it's called.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You go over and get that from your master's.
Yeah.
And there's definitely discrimination. So
yeah.
if people are hiring based on degrees, they're definitely going to look at that and be like, oh, your degree is not worth as much.
Mm-hmm.
But once you're in CRM, like, it's true. Like, even if you go straight through master's, or, you know, undergraduate, master's, and PhD, you're going to be a tech. No one's going to hire you, and you're getting hired. You're not getting hired on that degree, really. They're kind of yeah. like, okay, whatever. You're being hired on, have you done CRM before?
And CRM so, locally, usually.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
That's huge. So
yeah.
that's another thing that can kind of hurt you, is if you go across overseas and you get experience overseas, you know, that's the biggest complaint in like in CRM in the US. And it's mm-hmm. a big complaint in the UK as well, for archaeology over here when you're doing development led, is they're like, yeah, okay, so you dug in Cyprus. That
right.
has nothing to do with the UK. But again, if you don't have that experience, if you don't have actually professional experience, you're pretty much in the same boat. Maybe they're going to hire the local degree or the person who did the local field school
yeah.
over you. And there's yeah. going to be that discrimination. But as soon as you have your first CRM job, you're most likely, and again, different employers are different ways. Some people are mm-hmm. still snotty and, you know, uppity and all that stuff. But for the most part, when it comes to that master's, it's like, oh, can you turn that in to get permitted? And as
yes.
long as you have your degree accredited, that's all they're going to care about. That's not like, if you're looking at the person with like 10 years of experience, but a UK degree, and someone with 2 years of experience, but a US degree, they're going to take that person with 10 years of, say, when I say experience, like CRM,
yeah.
US,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
it's they're always going to go with that. It's always going to be that local experience.
Totally. I think you're totally right. That's how yeah. I would play this game. It's like I would get the 1 year master's, but then think of it as it fulfills that Secretary of the Interior, you know, stipulation, right? You're not being hired on your degree necessarily yet. It's like you get the degree, then you get the experience, and then you can use the degree as like kind of the icing on the cake to be like, yes, I also have a master's degree. And if for some reason you could do your degree, even though it's in the UK on US stuff, that would be all the better to make the world's most, you know, dynamic CRM person. But anyway,
well, it's what I did. I actually chose my dissertation at both for master's and PhD locations back in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. So I would have that employability, because that plan was always to come back.
Right.
And also like there's also people to like Leicester does like an online degree, and there'll be people.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people in CRM who basically, you know, after their work, they'll come back and they'll do the online degree just so they can get that master. So they'll have a couple of years of experience. They'll be field teching, maybe crew chiefing, you know, depending where you are and permits and stuff. But if they need to get that extra bump, again, even if you're doing it part-time, it's 2 years as opposed to like a four-year part-time. It's online and you can basically do it at sort of, you know, on your own and still cheaper than most places in the States.
Right.
And if you just need to get that degree and you don't want to give up, like, you know, go and spend a year just by yourself, you can do those online options. And again, you're going to have that experience. And then that's the best thing. I think where people run into problems is like, they maybe did an undergraduate. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because out of my cohort, I was the only one who would who came over who actually, I took a year off between my undergraduate and master's. I did CRM. I was the only one. And actually, a couple of people who came over basically just gone straight from undergraduate into master's, did the 1 year, went back, got accredited. And I mean, two of them are in archaeology now. It's typical of a lot of courses, you know, not everyone continues in the career. Didn't have any problems. One of them was a PI. Unfortunately, I believe they got injured and now can't. It had to do with basically balance stuff, inner ear thing. So basically can't, as far as I understand, can't go back to archaeology now. But they got all the way up to PI level in 5 years, 6 years. And that was going straight undergraduate, UK master's, coming back, going to CRM, and it did not affect their career at all.
Right.
I mean, that's actually quite fast to go up to a PI.
Oh, yeah. I can see how that world works. I can see how that works. You know what I mean? I would just, I would caution people just a little to beware like online degrees and that kind of stuff, because it works for what we're talking about. Like if you play this game just right, like what we're talking about, you're like, yeah, that's the time to do the 1 year master's, the online degree, that kind of thing. But in the broader world, I always recommend an on ground degree to online, right? If you have if you have a choice, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there'll be less stigma against it. And again,
and you'll learn more.
It's all about playing that. Well, we probably don't have enough time to jump into that.
I know. Oh, we can do that next time.
You dropped that bomb right at the end there, Andrew. I would like to argue with you.
You're back right at the end. I was waiting.
we'll save that for the next podcast.
Totally. That's a good one.
Yeah. But I would say, you know, you play the game. We're talking about playing the game. I'd also say it's not going to affect you either for if you're going into academia as well, because I've done the numbers, various publication reports. I think I put it on my blog where I looked at every person who did a PhD, you know, everyone teaching archaeology in the US, and there's, you know, a couple of percentage of those people got their degrees in the UK.
Right.
I think the UK is the next biggest. It's like Canada, because, you know, obviously so close and stuff like that. But, you know, it does not, hasn't really had an effect. Same for like US degrees going across to the UK to teach. You know, it's only a couple of percentage points. It's a couple dozen people. It's not a lot.
Yeah.
But it's not one of those things where like the US has totally blocked out anyone who's ever gotten a UK degree and they can't.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No. And I work with those people from time to time. They're around. Like I see them in local California archaeology from time to time. And I definitely see them like when I work in Belize, you know, like, I don't want people to think that it's some just, it's a dark hole and there's no way out or something. Not at all. I see those people. So dude, with that, I guess.
We're at 25 minutes, man. Yeah. We've gone over.
So I guess to wrap it up, Doug, dude, I just thought that was fascinating. Thank you for talking about that. My students have asked me this my entire career and I had like, you know, no idea what to tell them. I guess my last question as we wrap up, you just mentioned your blog, you know, for a moment. What's the title of your blog? Like, where do I find your blog?
Oh, man, it's pretty simple. It's Doug's Archaeology.
Oh, Doug's Archaeology. There you go.
Yeah, you'd have to go back. I did that, maybe like 2014, that analysis and stuff.
Yeah. Good.
It's buried in there. But I mean, I looked at it and it has no effect. There's other... A degree in this day and age is, there's definitely a snottiness, a turning up noses about where you get degrees. You can't avoid that.
Right.
But that happens internally. You know, people always put Harvard above. Andrew, where is the community college you teach at?
Oh, Moore Park College. Moore Park.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, like, to be honest, like, you probably give a much better education than anyone
I
received.
I do. That is the joke. And I'm not just bragging about myself. You know, like the community college system in general is structured to teach rather than research. But again, another, you know, topic for another time. Man. Anyway, I just thought that kicked ass. And I guess on our rollout, hope everybody enjoyed it. We now know about what to do internationally in the UK if we go there from the United States to get an education. And we will see you next time. And as Chris says, we will see you in the field.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.